I thought, well, somebody is being a righteous idiot. Why would they think that shaming would make people comply?
An unknown group tries to shame Alaskans to vote next week. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a fire destroys an alcohol treatment center under construction in Bethel.
We're keeping an eye on it, though. Lucky it's far enough away. But what a waste of a brand new building, huh? Golly.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
BP Alaska, as part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
Letters from an unknown group calling itself the Alaska State Voter Project are appearing in Alaska mailboxes. They purport to be aimed at boosting voter turnout by listing the voting history of the addressee along with that of other community members. Many recipients are outraged, saying the letters are an attempt to shame them into voting. APRN's Liz Ruskin talked to a political scientist who says the letter is very familiar to him.
If you're registered to vote, your name, address, and party affiliation is a public record available through the Division of Elections. So is the record of whether or not you voted in past elections. But judging by the reaction on social media, a lot of Alaskans think a person's voter history should be private. Margie Hall, a nurse from Eagle River, got a letter by email and regular mail that listed her voting history, her husband's, and that of other people the letter claimed were her friends, neighbors, and colleagues.
I thought, well, somebody is being a righteous idiot. Why would they think that shaming would make people comply?
Because, well, it does. That's according to Chris Larimer, associate professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. And he's done the research to prove it.
We found that when you make people aware of the norm of voting and that someone else is going to observe whether or not you vote, people are more likely then to vote.
The letter from the so-called Alaska State Voter Project is nearly identical, word for word, to the one that he and other researchers tested in Michigan, right down to the typography and punctuation. In that 2006 research, Larimer and colleagues sent voters one of four different letters. The softest message just urged people to do their civic duty and vote. The most aggressive letter is the one that matches the Alaska missive. It included the addressee's voting history as well as those of their neighbors. Like the Alaska one, it contained something of a threat. It promised a follow-up letter to show the results of the upcoming election. Larimer says they got complaints, but the technique worked quite well.
As you ratchet up that social pressure, or the sense that other people are going to watch whether or not you comply with a particular norm, we found that turnout increases dramatically, such that in that last mailing, what we call the neighbor's mailing, which is, again, what's being used in Alaska, we found effects that are similar to those that you observe through door-to-door canvassing.
Larimer says door-knocking campaigns tend to increase turnout 8 to 9 percentage points.
We found that 8-point effect with just using a very simple mailer, so a much more cost-effective way to increase turnout.
And, he says, in a later experiment, they showed a shaming letter is particularly effective. Not that he'd advise a campaign to use such methods. He says a softer approach with positive messages is less likely to produce backlash. Groups on both the right and left have used this research in past elections by sending letters only to people leaning their way. A group called America Votes that's affiliated with labor unions says it's sending Alaskans letters using public information to improve turnout. A spokeswoman declined to send a sample, saying she couldn't find one. The letter from the so-called State of Alaska Voter Project, the one that's caused the biggest stir, says it was paid for by Opportunity Alliance PAC. Its chief donor is 81-year-old John Bryan of Oregon, who's a major contributor to conservative causes.
I haven't seen the letter. I don't know what the letter's all about.
In Alaska, Bryan has given $2,000 to U.S. candidate Dan Sullivan, but says what he mostly cares about is charter schools and school choice. He says he's supporting Republican Senate candidates because he thinks the current Senate logjam hampers his cause. He referred calls about the letter to Stuart Jolly, who until last year was the Oklahoma director for Americans for Prosperity. Jolly didn't return messages by deadline. In Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan is the lower-profile Sullivan candidate in the upcoming elections. Affixed to incumbent Governor Sean Parnell's campaign for re-election, Mayor Sullivan's bid for statewide office has been low-key. Few lawn signs, no press releases, and his campaign doesn't have its own website beyond a Facebook page not updated since July. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, Sullivan wants to bring his focus on fiscal issues to the governor's cabinet.
Let me just get this out of the way early on. With two Republican candidates named Dan Sullivan running for state office, this election cycle has been even more confusing than normal. But the next 4 or so minutes are entirely about Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan, who first arrived in town before the city, or the state for that matter, were transformed by waves of money and development.
Then in 1959, we moved down to Anchorage. It was literally still a small town in those days. You know, we grew up by the Park Strip on 12th Avenue, and those were dirt roads in those days, and we kind of just take for granted.
This is Sullivan's first run for statewide office. After 9 years on the Anchorage Assembly, he was elected mayor in 2009 and then again in 2012. Having hit his term limit, Sullivan decided to run for lieutenant governor and says he wants to bring his record of financial prudence to the governor's inner circle.
As lieutenant governor, you are a member of the governor's cabinet. You have a seat at that table when policy is being developed and decisions are being made. And, you know, as the leader of the largest city in Alaska by far, the CEO of that city, I think I can lend some really valid experience to those discussions at those policy tables.
Sullivan is a pocketbook politician who makes financial issues his priority. Even his early memories of Alaska are inflected with details about dollars.
You know, I grew up in a time, you know, my youth before there was oil money. And I don't think we had any conception that we were somehow poor or lacking either in facilities or opportunities. And now that we've got billions in the bank, you know, students get charged for everything. And I still haven't quite figured that out.
The fiscal focus is part of Sullivan's identity as a candidate. He cites his biggest mayoral achievements as years of budget surpluses, improved credit ratings, and the controversial labor reform AO37 that'll appear on the ballot just a few inches from his name. Those who've worked with Sullivan in the past say it's not just political posturing.
As long as I've known him, he's been consistent in his philosophical beliefs.
In her 9 years on the Anchorage Assembly, Debbie Osiander worked closely with Sullivan and sees a straight line in the policies he pursued.
And I could have forecast that his focus would be on curtailing the budget and curtailing labor costs. He talked about that when he was on the Assembly, and it was no surprise to me that that was his focus when he was mayor.
Sullivan believes that since 55% of Alaska's population lives in Anchorage and the Mat-Su Valley, what's good for South Central is good for the state. Take, for example, an investment opportunity. He's eager to continue, if elected, modernizing the port of Anchorage.
Over 90% of all the goods that come into the state that are on the shelves throughout the interior western Alaska come through that port. This port is so crucial to the entire state. That's probably job number one in my mind. And it's kind of self-serving because it's my city and my port.
Sullivan's current plan for overseeing the Division of Elections, one of the few concrete functions of the Lieutenant Governor's office, are mostly managerial modifications that make the organization run more efficiently, a lot like those that he sought at the municipal level while he was mayor. It's another example of Sullivan's stance that the laws of business should be harnessed to better deliver government. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, scientists use drones to identify hibernating bears on the North Slope.
A sleeping bear is actually burning calories and radiating heat, and you can pick that up with a camera.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Nana Regional Corporation, and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Officials are investigating a large fire in Bethel that started just after 8 p.m. Monday night behind the post office. The fire destroyed an alcohol treatment center under construction by the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. KYUK's Daisha Eaton reports.
No one was hurt in the fire, and YKHC officials don't know how it started. The Bethel Fire Department responded to the blaze just after 8 o'clock on Monday night. A cloud of orange lit up the southwest Alaska town's horizon and could be seen across town. Marlon Lake, who lives in Chivac, stood outside in the rain nearby the fire, looking on in disbelief. The 21-year-old says he'd just been released from the hospital when he stepped outside and noticed the fire.
When I first came out of the hospital, I saw just big flames going up in the air. There was a couple explosions, and yeah, there's another explosion going on. Big flames and everything.
YKHC officials say the $12.5 million alcohol treatment center had been under construction for about a year. The center was meant to be a 16-bed regional facility.
Guys, can't block this road. Emergency vehicle's going to be coming through. Go back.
Go back.
Get off the road.
Hurry up.
Besides doing traffic control, Jerry Fredericks with the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative, or AVEC, was keeping an eye on the town's diesel power plant just about 1,000 yards away.
We're keeping an eye on it, though. Lucky it's far enough away. But what a waste of a brand-new building, huh? Golly. This is the new PATC building. So.
Do you know how far along they were?
Yeah, they were just putting the roofs on. I mean, they had the roofs on, and it's this foam panel building. They're called SIPs. They're insulated panels. And you can see how hot they burn.
Up closer, the building crackles and pops as rain and snow fall. That's where Dan Winkelman, the president and CEO of YKHC, was fielding phone calls. He said he was most concerned about safety.
I just don't want anyone to get hurt, any of the fire crews or anyone. You know, contain the fire as best they can. Thank everyone for that. But I don't want anyone to get hurt over this.
Winkelman told KYUK in an email Monday night that he doesn't believe the building is a total loss. He says the foundation is good, as well as some panels and other materials at the site. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A Fairbanks Catholic priest accused of trying to produce child pornography underwent a 2-stage screening process as part of his hire and ordination. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
57-year-old Clint Michael Landry was arrested Friday after a federal grand jury indicted him earlier last week on 1 count of attempted production of child pornography and 1 count of attempted coercion and enticement of a minor to participate in the production of the porn. According to the indictment, the latter charge stems from Landry's alleged attempt to get a youth to, quote, engage in sexually explicit conduct on May 18th and 19th. The indictment states that Landry planned to transmit a live depiction of that conduct. Ronnie Rosenberg is Director of Human Resources for the Catholic Diocese of Fairbanks, and she's also its legal coordinator. Rosenberg says officials with the diocese responded immediately when they learned about the alleged incidents.
As soon as we thought that there may be a problem with computer usage, the computers were secured, and we called the Alaska State Troopers. They, in turn, turned it over to the FBI.
The diocese also placed Landry on leave that week. Rosenberg can't go into detail about the case, but she says the diocese followed its policy in responding to the situation.
We immediately report anything suspicious, any kind of suspicious activity of this nature, to law enforcement so that we don't taint an investigation. We let law enforcement take it from there.
Landry served as priest at Sacred Heart Cathedral after he was ordained there in 2011. He came here in 2009 from New Orleans, where he taught school. Rosenberg says the Fairbanks Diocese screened Landry, as it does for all prospective employees, and then subjected him to additional screening that the diocese requires for all those seeking the priesthood and those who will be working with children and youth.
Well, he would go through our standard clergy screening, and that was done prior to his coming here while he was still a candidate in the seminary. And then when he moved here, it was repeated.
The indictment doesn't identify the alleged victim. It states the person is under 18 and identifies him or her using only the initials CJ. Landry was arraigned Friday afternoon in Fairbanks via video teleconference with a federal judge and prosecutor in Anchorage. Court documents say a bail hearing is set for Friday. A trial by jury is scheduled for December 22nd before U.S. District Judge Ralph Beistlein. If convicted, Landry faces up to 30 years in prison on the porn production count and up to 10 years for the attempted coercion count. He also faces up to $250,000 fine for each count and the possibility of lifetime supervised release after serving time. Court documents state Fairbanks attorney Bill Satterberg was retained as Landry's counsel. Neither Satterberg nor Assistant U.S. Attorney Kyle Reardon returned calls from KUAC Monday afternoon. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above.
The way the city and borough of Juneau currently disposes of its sewage isn't sustainable, and the long-term solution consultants are recommending will be expensive. KTOO's Jeremy Shea reports.
City Engineering Director Rory Watt began his remarks to the assembly like this.
I don't know that I have any good news for you in all this.
Hired consultants recommended in September that the city build a 7,100-square-foot facility at the Juneau Douglas Wastewater Treatment Plant off Thane Road. The new facility would dry sewage sludge, burn it as fuel in a furnace, then feed heat back into the drying process. The only waste would be an inert ash. The consultants estimated such a facility would cost $28.7 million to build. Meanwhile, the city is bracing for another year of budget deficits. Mayor Merrill Sanford pointed out that the city plans to request some $22 million in grant money from the state for the project.
Which is probably not necessarily feasible or not necessarily that it's going to happen with the shortage of funds at the state level, too.
The Juneau Assembly Finance Committee intends to hear from the city's sustainability and planning commissions about the proposal and examine options for paying for the new facility. The Finance Committee's next meeting is November 12th. For now, Waste Management is shipping the sewage sludge to a landfill it owns in Oregon under a tenuous 5-year contract.
We, as efficiently as possible, want to drive towards moving forward to not loading shipping containers full of sludge for lots of obvious reasons. We really need to move beyond our current solution.
In a memo, perilous was the word Wastewater Utility Superintendent Samantha Stottinger and Engineering Project Manager Michelle Elfers used to describe the status quo. Waste Management was reluctant to be in the sewage sludge business after its last contract ended in 2013. The stopgap worked out earlier this year left Waste Management with the option to walk away at any time without consequence. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
The Bethel Food Pantry is having trouble getting enough food to open. They usually open in August or September, according to officials, but this year they won't open until November. The Bethel Lions Club runs the food pantry. Carol Ann Willard is president of the Bethel Lions Club and co-chair for the food bank.
Over the years, we've seen a decrease in the amount of food that we get from Food Bank of Alaska, basically the government food. Also, there's more people, a lot of new people. Every month, it seems like there's a lot of new people coming in and needing the food. So that's just the economy and people without jobs. And so the need has increased as well as the food supply has decreased.
Willard says as help from the government has dropped off, the pantry has been seeking more local support. Last year, the Bethel branch of Alaska USA Bank donated several thousand dollars so they could purchase food. The bank branch will be making a similar donation this year. In addition, Willard says Food Pantry is calling on local grocery stores to help out.
We're trying to partner with like the stores and other food service facilities in Bethel. We're always looking for partnerships. That helps us out a bit. Those are more like perishable items that we get, and so it's kind of time sensitive.
The Bethel Food Pantry is set to open on November the 15th. Someone appears to be poisoning bears near Sitka's Sawmill Creek Road. A young male found dead last week may be the latest to be killed. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Bears venturing into populated areas are sometimes killed in defense of life and property. But the State Fish and Game Department's Phil Mooney says the 475-pound, 4 to 5-year-old brown bear was definitely not shot.
There are no wounds on the bear, visible wounds on the outside. So the trauma took place in another manner. Could be poison.
He says the bear was found on top of bags of garbage it took from nearby homes. Brown bears are omnivorous, so they have, at times, consumed rat poison, radiator fluid, or other deadly substances. Mooney says this time, it wasn't random.
I think it's intentional. We've had a number of bears in that vicinity over the last, since 2005, that have kind of died like this.
How many?
Four.
So it would be accurate to say that this could be one in a series of bears poisoned in that area?
Yes, we believe that that's been the situation in that particular area for quite a while.
Mooney says the bear was in pretty bad shape by the time he got to it. He couldn't do a full necropsy, but collected samples of blood and urine that he sent off for testing. He has results from other bears that died in the area and will check for a connection. He also said garbage found at the scene could lead to action against its owner, but that would likely be for improper storage, not poisoning. Mooney says this bear was one of a small number active in town this year.
Sitka's pretty lucky that we don't get a lot of instances of bears breaking into buildings, and we had one bear that pulled a screen out of a window earlier this year and tried to pull itself up to get a fresh pizza that had just been come out of the oven, was sitting on the counter, and that was fairly unusual.
That bear was killed. Mooney says 3 to 4 young bears have done most of this year's trash raiding, with an occasional older male passing through. He says the bear season is nearing its end, but some will still be around for a while.
Most of those guys around here have moved on, typically around the 15th of October. A lot of the sub-adults that are still with the sow and cubs of the year, they move up to their den sites and get settled in. So you'll still have some sub-adult males, and you'll still have a couple of the big guys that'll poke around for probably another month, month and a half.
Mooney reminds residents to continue containing their garbage properly. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Sitka.
For the first time, Alaska researchers plan to use drones with thermal cameras to detect hibernating polar bears and grizzly bears on the North Slope. The University of Alaska Fairbanks team is working without dedicated funding, but is seeking industry support for the project. KTOO's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Federal law requires oil and gas companies to remain 1 mile away from polar bear dens and a half mile away from grizzly bear dens from November to April. Otherwise, they risk disturbing their hibernation with noise and vibration from vehicles and other off-road operations. Keith Cunningham is a research assistant professor at UAF and has worked on drone data and applications for various organizations.
On the North Slope right now, there are experts who are trained in chasing off bears that get too close to some of these oil production areas. We call that bear hazing. There may be bean bags or firecrackers that are shot at the bear to scare it away.
Cunningham says the drones will use specialized cameras to detect the bears.
These infrared cameras basically spot emitted thermal heat. A sleeping bear is actually burning calories and radiating heat, and you can pick that up with a camera.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game have been experimenting with artificial dens for several years. Part of the upcoming UAF research will involve constructing wooden dens and mimicking body heat using a device set to about 60 watts. Weather stations outside the dens will measure conditions like wind speed, wind direction, and temperature. Another device will measure snow depth and density. As they run trials, that data should tell the researchers how effective their drone is under different conditions. The goal is to provide this technology and information to oil and gas companies active on the North Slope. Cunningham says the team is interested in both polar bears and grizzly bears in the field.
As we get closer to the foothills of the Brooks Range, we're also interested in the denning activity of grizzly and brown bears because they'll dig their dens about the same time as the polar bear. The polar bear is digging his den in the snow, whereas the brown bear is going to dig his den in the dirt, like along a creek.
They will set up their first artificial den on the North Slope in early November. In the first stage, the researchers will test drones only on artificial dens. In the second stage, they'll test the drones on bears with radio collars that send location data to a satellite. Cunningham and other researchers have experimented with thermal cameras before, but this is the first time they'll use cameras and drones together to track bears. They're examining camera options, and they've already decided on the drone they'll use.
The university actually builds its own unmanned aircraft systems, and we have one that is designed specifically for research and development. And we call it the Ptarmigan. The Ptarmigan is the state bird of Alaska. It's got six propellers. It flies like a helicopter. It takes off vertically, and it lands vertically.
UAF sent their first drones into Alaska airspace in May with permission from the Federal Aviation Administration. The drone can fly for about 20 minutes before it needs a battery replacement. Cunningham says drones will fly lower and more quietly than manned aircraft. Wildlife biologist Anthony Krupe works for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and studies brown bears in Southeast. He and his colleagues use a variety of methods to trace large animals, including GPS collars and manned aircraft. While using drones makes sense in the treeless North Slope, Krupe says they're not a good fit for finding bear dens in Southeast.
They're such a secretive species that they really stick to the forested environment, and I think it would be difficult for us to be able to do things like counts on brown bears in Southeast.
Cunningham says there is plenty of interest in the Bear Den project from industry funders. The Bear Den team hopes to use the drones in the field by 2016. If it's a success, the researchers will conduct further experimentation to optimize the method. In Juneau, I'm Kayla Jaroche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Jeremy Shea and Kayla DeRoche in Juneau, and Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
The general election is November 4th. Polls are open 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. You'll be voting for U.S. Senator, U.S. Representative, Governor, Lieutenant Governor, State Senator, State Representative, and judges. When you go to vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the list or you don't have an ID, you may vote a question ballot. The question ballot updates your voter registration. If you need language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring somebody to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.